in cotton, and now more of it stacked up as patriotic planters subscribed to bonds with more of the worthless fiber. A small foreign loan of $14.5 million in France, negotiated by Emile Erlanger, brought in only $8.5 million. Thus, Memminger copied Chase, far surpassing him in the introduction of fiat money when the Confederate Congress began issuing Confederate notes in 1861. Starting slowly with only $1 million, wartime necessity soon drove the CSA to issue more than $1 billion in Confederate paper money, or more than double the number of greenbacks issued to a much larger population in the North. Before long, Confederate money attained a reputation for worthlessness previously seen only in the Revolutionary-era Continentals, and not seen again until the Weimar Republic's disastrous hyperinflation in the 1920s. This was in part because, unlike Chase and the Greenbacks, the Confederacy did not accept its paper money in payment for taxes. A Confederate dollar worth 82 cents in gold or silver in 1862 had plummeted to only $0.017 in 1865. Memminger never dreamed in 1862 that within a few years the Confederacy's needs for goods and services would become so desperate that the government would resort to outright confiscation, theft of private property. Already, however, the warning signs had appeared, heralding a type of war socialism. While the North skimmed off the top of private enterprise, the South, lacking an entrepreneurial base to match, was forced to put the ownership and control of war production in the hands of government. The Confederacy reached levels of government involvement unmatched until the totalitarian states of the 20th century. 7/8 of all freight moved on the Virginia Central Railroad was for the government's account. Government work done in Augusta, Georgia, by the main private company, the Augusta Textile Factory, accounted for 92% of its total. And the Confederate government created its own powder works, the second largest in the world. By the end of the war, all pretense to a free market, which Southern plantation slavery never was, had disappeared as President Jefferson Davis confiscated all railroads, steam vessels, telegraph lines, and other operations, impressing their employees for government or military work. Swarms of Confederate officials soon resembled King George's agents that Jefferson had warned about in the Declaration. As one North Carolinian recalled, government officials were thick as locusts in Egypt, and he could not walk without being elbowed off the street by them. Government bureaucrats not only confiscated food and other items, paying with the worthless money, but also forced both white and black workers into construction projects for the Confederacy. While it is true that the states often refused to cooperate with the Confederacy in mobilizing, the problem overall was too much government at all levels and not enough of a private sector base. If, as some claimed, the Confederacy died of democracy when it came to state resistance to coordinating with the Confederate government, on a different level, it died of too much government altogether. By 1863, the Confederacy was employing 70,000 civilian bureaucrats as the government itself ran ordnance bureaus, mills, clothing manufacturing, cotton gins, meat packing plants, salt storage sheds, distilleries, vegetable packing facilities, all the while forcing the industrialization of a rural region and literally sucking out its sustenance. Alabama produced four times as much iron in 1864 as any state had prior to the war. Yet by 1864, Confederate soldiers were starving in the field. Stories of rebels bartering with Yankees, exchanging shoes or even powder for food, were not uncommon by the end of the war. Across the board, in everything from the treatment of white human rights to freedom of speech and the press to market freedoms, scholar Richard Bensel found that the North had a less centralized government and was a much more open society than the South. 6 specific comparisons of private property rights between North and South, including control of railroads, destruction of property, and confiscation, showed the Confederacy to be far more government-centered and less market-oriented. The Proclamation. At the 7-day battles, despite failing to capture Richmond, McClellan's troops had inflicted heavy casualties on the rebels. Nevertheless, McClellan withdrew to the security of his gunboats. The 7 days' battles had provided an opportunity for McClellan to crush Lee, but once again the Union forces let the rebels off the hook. While McClellan rested, Lee attacked the newly formed Federal Army of Virginia under John Pope at Manassas. Although McClellan was ordered to send troops northward to join Pope, he executed his orders so slowly that Pope was crushed before the two federal forces could join. At that juncture, Lee considered his options. Increasingly lacking foreign support, the South perceived that it needed to deliver a knockout punch. Lee decided to invade Maryland. Misled into thinking the Marylanders would support the Confederate Army, Lee announced he was coming to liberate a sister state. Swinging far to the west, away from Washington, the rebel army entered Maryland at, fittingly, Leesburg on September 5, 1862. Dispatching Jackson with 25,000 men to seize Harper's Ferry, Lee divided his force in the face of superior odds. McClellan, meanwhile, had by default regained overall command of the army in the East. Given the low quality of other commanders, he was Lincoln's only real choice. His men loved him. He was plodding, but he had inflicted terrible damage on the rebel army. At the 7 days' battles, for example, despite failing to capture Richmond, McClellan had licked Lee's best forces. At that point, a jewel fell into McClellan's hands. A Union soldier picked up 3 cigars off a fallen rebel officer and found them wrapped in the actual orders Lee had given his company commanders. All the battle plans McClellan needed, the disposition of the rebel army, its size, everything, had just dropped into his lap. He even enthusiastically announced to his staff, "Here is a paper with which, if I cannot whip Bobby Lee, I will be willing to go home." Lee suddenly realized that McClellan was displaying unusual aggressiveness and that Union armies were converging on him like bats to fruit. Unwilling to forego the siege of Harper's Ferry that promised to bag 15,000 Union troops, he selected Sharpsburg, Maryland, along Antietam Creek, as a point of concentration in the center of his dispositions. There, the Potomac River protected his left and rear, but if the Union overran his position, it also would have him in a killing box. On September 15th, McClellan's advance forces located the Confederates and should have attacked immediately. Instead, despite outnumbering the rebels 87,000 to 35,000, McClellan hesitated. Finally, 2 days later, the battle commenced. While all the fighting exceeded human description in its savagery and desperation, the worst of the carnage occurred when Union forces attacked across open ground against Confederates located in a sunken road. The Federals attacked from the northwest, but were uncoordinated due to the absence of a commanding general on the field. The Yankees soon outflanked the road to the south, peppering the southern ranks with fire from the front and 2 sides. On September 18th, the Confederates withdrew and, incredibly, McClellan did not pursue them. Lee left the field, allowing McClellan to claim victory, but neither side could take much heart in the combined numbing losses of 24,000 men killed or wounded. It was the single bloodiest day in American history, September 11, 2001, notwithstanding. Although the numbers of men littering the battlefield in blue and gray uniforms were almost evenly divided, the Confederates again absorbed a disproportionate amount of punishment, losing well over 22% of their entire force. Yet McClellan inexplicably missed an opportunity to pursue Lee and use his superiority to end the war. An aggressive follow-up attack might have finished Lee off then and there, and McClellan's failure cemented his dismissal. Yet Lee's withdrawal under federal guns gave Lincoln the window of opportunity he needed to inform his cabinet of one of the most important proposals in American history. For several years, Frederick Douglass, the former slave who used his newspaper as a clarion for abolitionist columns, had edged Lincoln toward the abolitionist camp. He expressed his frustration that Lincoln had not embraced abolition as the central war aim in 1861 and continued to lament the president's unwillingness throughout 1862. After the Emancipation Proclamation, however, Douglass observed of Lincoln, "From the genuine abolition view, Mr. Lincoln seemed tardy, cold, dull, and indifferent, but measuring him by the sentiment of his country, a sentiment he was bound as a statesman to consult, he was swift, zealous, radical, and determined." Lincoln had inched further toward emancipation since July 1862, when he had met with a group of border state representatives in the White House with another proposal for gradual, compensated emancipation in the border states. "The war has doomed slavery," he told them, "and if they rejected compensation at that time, they would not get a penny when it disappeared." He received a chilly reception. Why should they, loyal Unionists, free their slaves when there was a chance that the rebels might still come back into the Union and keep theirs? Lincoln could not disagree with their reasoning. That meeting impressed upon him that, if abolition was to come, it must commence in the rebel South and then be expanded into the loyal border states. Truly, it was a Damascus Road experience for the president. The following day, in a carriage ride with William Seward and Navy Secretary Gideon Welles, Lincoln stunned the two cabinet officials by stating that given the resistance and persistence of the Confederates, it was a necessity and a duty to liberate the slaves. Before the flabbergasted secretaries could respond, they saw a different Lincoln, one who, in an urgent voice, informed them that the time had passed when the two sections could reach an amicable agreement. He intended to rip out the heart of the rebellion, destroy the institution that had torn the nation asunder, and end the charade that the South could reject the Constitution that created the Union on the one hand and invoke it to protect slavery on the other. Lincoln had firmed up in his own mind the issue that had nagged at him for years, in the process ensuring his place in the shrine of American history by finally linking the Declaration and the Constitution over the issue of slavery. The war was not about union, after all, because the Union, as a constitutional entity, was itself the result of something else. He put it best at Gettysburg when he said that it was dedicated to the proposition that all men are created equal. A union not dedicated to that proposition was no union at all. Thus, he seemed to realize, for years he had placed the cart ahead of the horse. For the United States as a union of states to have any moral force at all, it first had to stand for the proposition of equality before the law. The rebels' actions were despicable not only because they rent that legal fabric embodied in the Constitution, but also because they rejected the underlying proposition of the Declaration. So it is critical that an understanding of emancipation begin with Lincoln's perception that it first and foremost was a moral and legal issue, not a military or political one. However, Lincoln also understood the plexiform nature of emancipation as it involved the war effort. Militarily, it would threaten the South's massive slave support system that took the place of civilian or non-combatant military personnel behind the lines. Diplomatically, it struck at the heart of rebel efforts to gain British and French support, and economically, it threatened to throw what was left of the Confederate financial system into chaos, depending as it did on slave valuations as assets used by planters to secure loans. The more Lincoln looked at emancipation, the more he liked it. Congress had moved toward emancipation with its Second Confiscation Act, which stated that if the rebellion did not cease in 60 days, the executive would be empowered to confiscate all property of anyone who participated in, aided, or abetted the rebellion. Lincoln thought such half-measures impractical. Therefore, he determined to brush slavery away in a giant stroke, taking the burden upon himself. On July 22, 1862, he read the preliminary Emancipation Proclamation to his cabinet, making the abolition of slavery an objective of the Union war effort come January 1, 1863. Despite the presence of many solid free soilers and anti-slavery politicians in the cabinet, the response was tepid at best. Chase ruminated about the financial impact, possibly destabilizing the fragile banking structure. Secretary of War Stanton and Postmaster General Montgomery Blair, though supportive, nevertheless expressed grave reservations. They argued that the nation was not ready for such a step, whereas Seward feared that the Europeans would see the proclamation as a sign of weakness, our last shriek on the retreat. For it to appear legitimate, they argued, emancipation must wait until the Union had a victory in the Eastern Theater. Grant's piecemeal deconstruction of rebel forces in the West was deadly efficient, but it did not constitute a good old whipping of Bobby Lee. Lincoln found those arguments persuasive. He appreciated that emancipation would produce some violent responses in the North as well as the South. There would be race riots, for example. So Lincoln used the remainder of the summer of 1862 to soften up the opposition by touting colonization again, a subject that he trotted out more as a deflector shield than a serious option. In August 1862, he met with several black leaders in Washington, informing them of a new colonization plan in Central America. "You and we are different races," he noted, "and whites had inflicted great wrong on blacks. Oppression would only continue in freedom," he predicted, and he urged the leaders to consider colonization. Some supported it, but Frederick Douglass called Lincoln a hypocrite, full of pride of race and blood. Lincoln, of course, was neither. He was a practical politician who realized that the highest ideals had already demanded phenomenal sacrifices and that even in emancipation, the job would just be beginning. Douglass's sincerely felt condemnations aside, Lincoln had moved steadily but inexorably toward emancipation and racial equality. A famous open letter in the Tribune to Horace Greeley, who, like Douglass, thought Lincoln too timid, contained the lines, "My paramount objective in this struggle is to save the Union, and is not either to save or destroy slavery. If I could save the Union without freeing any slaves, I would do it. And if I could save it by freeing all the slaves, I would do it." Missed in the debate about Lincoln's opinion on race is the fact that he had taken in this Tribune letter another concrete step toward emancipation by claiming in public the authority to free the slaves, something neither he nor any other president had ever advanced. As with a play fake in football, Lincoln allowed his own views of race to mesmerize proponents and opponents of abolition, absorbing both the attention and the punishment, while his actions moved unflinchingly toward freedom. Then came the news from McClellan at Antietam. It was an incomplete victory, but a victory nonetheless. Lincoln had the moment he had waited for and called his cabinet together on September 22, 1862, to read them the proclamation. For the border states, he would urge Congress to pass compensated emancipation. For freed slaves who so desired, he would press for colonization. but for the states still in rebellion as of January 1, 1863, the president, on his own authority, would free, thenceforward and forever, all slaves, and the military forces of the United States would protect their liberty. After entertaining criticisms, including the possibility of a mass slave uprising in the South, Lincoln went ahead to publish the decree the following day. Much has been made of the claim that not a single slave was freed by the proclamation itself, when, in fact, slaves held in Union-controlled Southern territories and those whose status as contraband remained in doubt were now free. But by a broad generalization, it was more or less true. Those states still in rebellion were not under federal control, and thus no slaves were freed in the South. Since the proclamation said nothing about the border states, except that Lincoln would urge Congress to act there as well, no slaves were actually free there either. Thus, the famous charge that where he could free the slaves, Lincoln would not, and where he would free the slaves, he could not, has a measure of truth to it. Nevertheless, word filtered south through the slave grapevine like wildfire, although slaves attempted to hide the fact that they had heard about the proclamation. Southern whites had suspicions that blacks had kept up with news of the war. A Louisiana planter complained that his slaves know more about politics than most of the white men. They know everything that happens. Odd as it may seem, changing the status of slaves constituted only one of three critical goals of the proclamation. The second objective, and the one most easily achieved, involved perceptions. Lincoln needed to turn, in the eyes of Europe, particularly England and France, a set of brave Confederate revolutionaries into international pariahs. By shifting the war aims from restoring the Union, which evoked neither excitement nor sympathy abroad, to emancipation, Lincoln tapped into a strong current of Western thought. Both England and France had abolished slavery in their empires in the decades before the Civil War on strictly moral grounds. They could hardly retreat on that position now. As long as Jefferson Davis's diplomats could maintain the pretense that the war was a struggle for independence on the grounds of constitutional rights, not much different than the rights of Englishmen, then they could still hope for foreign support. Once Lincoln ripped away the facade of constitutionality and exposed the rebellion for what it was, an attempt by some to legitimate their enslavement of others, neither Britain nor France could any longer consider offering aid. Lincoln's third objective, little commented upon because of its abstruse effects, was in fact to yank out the underpinnings from the entire Southern slave plantation structure. In the twinkling of an eye, Lincoln, in theory at least, had transformed millions of dollars worth of physical assets, no different from wagons, cattle, or lumber, into people. For the purposes of banking, the impact could not have been more staggering. Slaves, property, showed up on Southern bank books as assets, along with the plantation land backing enormous planters' debts. And now, in an instant, they had, again in theory, suddenly disappeared as mysteriously as the Roanoke colony. Slaves backed millions of dollars in plantation assets, not just in their physical persons, but also in the value that they imposed on the land. Without the slaves, much of the plantation land was worthless, and the entire Southern banking structure, at one time as solid as a rock, turned to mush. A fourth notion regarding the Emancipation Proclamation, however, must be addressed. Left-wing revisionists have argued that Lincoln freed the slaves mainly because he needed the black troops to feed his war machine, that only with the addition of African-American soldiers could the North have won. This wrong-headed view not only deliberately and obviously trivializes Lincoln's genuine sentiments about emancipation, but also cynically and mistakenly discounts the efforts of white troops. It would soon be white Mainers and New Yorkers, not black troops, who would smash Lee at Gettysburg. and although black troops fought at Port Hudson and in the Vicksburg campaign, the bulk of the action was carried by white units from Indiana and Illinois and Ohio. Predominantly northern white troops would, a year after that, force the surrender of Atlanta and Columbia and Mobile. But until the 1960s, historians had too long ignored or diminished the contributions of the 179,000 African American soldiers plus 18,000 sailors, most of whom fought in American uniforms for the first time ever. At Fort Wagner, black troops bravely but vainly stormed beachfront Confederate citadels before being repulsed, with black and white alike leaving thousands of casualties in the sand. Their courageous efforts late in the war, especially at their own prodding at Petersburg, undoubtedly contributed to the Union victory in important ways. Nevertheless, it is just as wrong-headed to overstate the significance of black troops in the Union Army as it was to ignore them in the first place. By late 1864, the doom of the Confederacy was sealed, no matter what color Grant's forces were. Some states, such as Massachusetts, had urged the creation of black regiments since 1861, but Lincoln resisted, fearing a white backlash. Massachusetts would eventually put nearly 4,000 black soldiers in the field, fourth only to the much larger states of Pennsylvania, Ohio, and New York. A change had occurred, though, in the thinking of Lincoln about the use of newly freed slaves between the preliminary Emancipation Proclamation and the January Proclamation, which was demonstrated by the fact that the latter announced the intention of admitting freedmen into military service. Certainly the dwindling recruitment numbers produced an attitude shift of its own in the North. Whites who previously had opposed arming blacks warmed to the idea of black soldiers in Union ranks. Large-scale black recruitment began in 1863. One sticking point was their unequal pay, mandated by the Militia Act of 1862, of $10 per month minus $3 for clothing, rather than $13 per month plus clothing given to white recruits. Governor John Andrew of Massachusetts offered state money to offset the pay differential to the 54th and 55th Massachusetts regiments, but the black troops refused. Equality had to be acknowledged from Washington. Congress finally equalized black and white pay in June 1864. By that time, blacks had entered the Union Army in large numbers, yet often, though not exclusively, found themselves on guard duty or in physical labor battalions, not combat. Lobbying the War Department, blacks finally saw action at Fort Wagner, South Carolina, July 1863, and Port Hudson, Louisiana, May to June 1863. It was not until 1865, outside Richmond, however, that Grant used large numbers of blacks routinely alongside whites. While the grueling reduction of the Richmond defenses was bloody, the war had been decided months earlier at Gettysburg, Vicksburg, and Atlanta. Thus, the fact that black soldiers did not by themselves tip the balance to the Union makes the Emancipation Proclamation all the more critical and, in context, brilliant. Even if the Confederacy somehow managed to string together several victories so as to make its military position sound, the financial chaos and instability caused by Lincoln's lone declaration would have been difficult to counteract. Hard war, unresolved war. Lincoln could call Antietam a victory, but the Army of Northern Virginia remained as deadly as ever. As if to underscore that fact, in October, Lee sent Jeb Stuart's cavalry on a raid of Chambersburg, Pennsylvania. Riding around McClellan, Stuart terrified Northerners and again embarrassed Lincoln, who replaced the general for the last time. In McClellan's stead came the new commander of the Army of the Potomac, Ambrose Burnside, an honest and modest man who was an effective subordinate, but not the war chieftain Lincoln needed. Indeed, Burnside had twice refused earlier offers of command because he doubted his own ability. At the same time as he replaced McClellan in the East, Lincoln removed General Don Carlos Buell in the West, also for lack of aggressiveness. After a series of disastrous appointments and counterappointments, Lincoln sent William S. Rosecrans to take command of the Army of the Cumberland. Fortunately, the musical chairs of commanders from the Ohio region had little impact on Grant and his vice around Vicksburg. Whatever the Union Army accomplished in the West seemed unimpressive to Washington politicians and war critics, if for no other reason than the press and the politicians were in Washington, not Cincinnati. Thus, Burnside's new offensive would be closely watched. The new general drafted a plan to march to Fredericksburg and from there to Richmond. Neither Lincoln nor his commander-in-chief, Henry Halleck, liked it, since both perceived that Burnside would have to move faster than any other Union commander save Grant had moved before. In mid-November 1862, Burnside's forces arrived at Fredericksburg. The Confederates had plenty of time to entrench on Mary's Heights, overlooking the city and a railroad line, with 78,000 men across the Rappahannock River waiting for Burnside. Once the Union Army had drawn up, with the hills in front and the river at its back, Lee had a perfect field of fire against an almost helpless foe. Burnside sent wave after wave of men up the hills in 14 suicidal charges against the dug-in Confederates, who slaughtered them in every attempt. When the Yankees finally withdrew, with 12,700 Union troops killed, wounded, or missing, Burnside had earned the unwelcome distinction of suffering the worst defeat ever by the U.S. Army. To the general's credit, he begged an audience with Lincoln to publicly accept blame for the defeat, the first Union general to do so. On January 26th, Lincoln fired the general who had known from the start he was in over his head, but he did so with great regret. Next in line was Fighting Joe Hooker. Hooker's brief stint as commander exemplified all of the difficulties Lincoln had in finding a general. Whereas Burnside was incompetent but honest, Hooker was an intriguer and ladder climber who had positioned himself for command in the East from the get-go. If Burnside almost desperately tried to avoid the mantle of command, Hooker lusted after it. With a reinforced Army of the Potomac numbering 130,000 men, Hooker planned to distract Lee with a movement at Fredericksburg, then march up the Rappahannock to attack his flank near Chancellorsville, where the Union would keep a huge reserve force. Lee ascertained the Federal plan and disrupted it by sending Jeb Stuart's cavalry to take control of the roads around Chancellorsville. That blinded Hooker, who delayed his planned attack. Lee then divided his highly outnumbered forces and sent Stonewall Jackson through a thicket known as the Wilderness to the Federal flank, where he achieved numerical superiority at the point of attack. Jackson's march would have been impossible for many units, but not Stonewall's trained corps. On May 2, 1863, when the rebels emerged from the dense brush, the stunned Union troops panicked. Lee still remained in front of them with, they thought, his entire army. Who were these new troops? The Union army nearly fell apart, but it held together long enough to prevent a total rout. Another telegram reached Lincoln, who could only pace back and forth, his hands behind his back, asking in despair, my God, what will the country say? What will the country say?" To Stanton, Lincoln privately confided, "Our cause is lost. We are ruined. This is more than I can endure." Although the Confederacy won another impressive victory, it suffered, again, heavy losses, 10,746 casualties, 20.8% of Lee's total forces, to the Union's 11,116, 16.4%. By now, Lee had lost an incredible one-quarter of his field force. By itself, that ratio would lead to ultimate Confederate defeat if Lee won 8 to 10 more such battles. An even more staggering loss was dealt to the rebel army at Chancellorsville, and not by a Yankee. Stonewall Jackson, reconnoitering well past his lines with a few of his officers, was mistakenly shot by Confederate pickets. It took him more than a week to die, removing, as it were, Lee's right hand. Jackson's value to the Confederate cause cannot be overstated. After his death, the South won only one other major battle, at Chickamauga. South Carolinian James Pete Longstreet, a competent corps commander, assumed Jackson's role as Lee's most trusted subordinate, but never replaced Stonewall. Union defeat at Chancellorsville ensured the removal of the isolated Hooker, whose female camp followers, Hookers, provided a linguistic legacy of a different sort. Lincoln was back at square one, still looking for a commanding general. In the meantime, the Confederates, perhaps sensing that their losses had started to pile up at rates they could not possibly sustain, and knowing that Vicksburg was in peril, mounted one more bold and perilous invasion of the North, upon which, conceivably, hung the fate of the war. Gettysburg. Despite triumphs in Chancellorsville, Fredericksburg, and the Wilderness, nothing in the strange equation had changed for the Confederacy. Quite the contrary, the rebels had, over the course of four battles in the East, every one a victory, lost more than 36,000 men, and come no closer to independence than when they had opened fire on Fort Sumter. Given the trend in the West, the Army of Northern Virginia could do only three things by May 1863 that might have produced the desired result of an independent CSA. First, through an invasion, Lee could capture Washington. That was a remote possibility at best. Even if the federal troops around the city were as poorly led as the forces at Fredericksburg or Bull Run, a series of forts surrounded Washington that would require a long siege. Certainly the armies in the West would instantly rush reinforcements over. Second, Lee, if he could raise enough hell in the North and agitate enough politicians, might make the war so politically unpalatable that the forces of democracy would demand Lincoln negotiate terms with the South. Perhaps some in the Confederate cabinet still clung to such fantasies, but Lee, who had seen the unwelcome reception his men received in friendly Maryland, knew better. The bastions of Unionism, Pennsylvania, New York, and especially Massachusetts, would see an invasion as exactly that, and civilians would respond with a predictable level of hostility and guerrilla warfare. Only the third alternative really represented a realistic chance for the Confederacy. Bring the Union Army, the larger part of it, into one big battle and defeat it. Once Lee disengaged from Hooker, he turned northwest, using the Blue Ridge Mountains to cover his northerly advance into Pennsylvania. He learned through newspapers that Lincoln had sacked Hooker in June and replaced him with a corps commander, George Meade, whom the men likened to an old snapping turtle. But Lee's well-oiled machine began to slow down. First, Jeb Stuart, supposedly scouting for Lee in the Pennsylvania countryside, crossed into Maryland on May 15th. One of his tasks involved confusing federal intelligence as to the disposition of Lee's main forces. But Stuart, a dandy who wore plumes in his hats and perfume on his mustache, enjoyed the adulation he received in the Southern press. On June 9th, Stuart, with 10,000 of his cavalry, considered nearly invincible, ran headlong into Union forces under Alfred Pleasonton at Brandy Station in the largest cavalry engagement in American history. As 20,000 horsemen slashed at each other and blasted away with pistols, the Union troopers were finally driven off. But in defeat, the Union cavalry knew that they had gone toe-to-toe with the finest the South had to offer, and under other and better circumstances, could prevail. Stuart disengaged and then headed straight for the Union supply lines. At Rockville, Maryland, the rebel cavalry surprised a massive wagon train and captured more than 125 wagons, which slowed down Stuart's movement. He continued to ride around the Federal Army into Pennsylvania and was out of touch with Lee for 10 critical days. Seeking to intercept Lee's army, Meade had marched west into Maryland along the Taneytown Road. Already, though, advance units of both armies approached Gettysburg. Lee came up from the southwest and had ordered other divisions to swing down from the north and west. Spies informed him of the proximity of the Federal Army, which counted 7 corps, roughly 80,000 men. Lee had approximately 75,000 men in 3 corps. Confederates always weighed their divisions and corps more than did the Union Army, including Stuart's cavalry, which arrived on the second day of combat. General John Buford's Union cavalry arrived on the scene to the southwest of Gettysburg. Buford instantly perceived that the ground behind the city, along Cemetery Ridge with Culp's Hill on the west and the Round Tops on the east, provided an incredibly advantageous natural defensive position. Buford commanded only 1,200 men and had in his sight 20,000 Confederates, but by holding the rebels up for hours, Buford and his men bought critical hours for Meade. Lee had hoped to avoid closing with the enemy until he had his entire army drawn up, but on July 1st it was spread all over roads in a 25-mile radius around southwestern Gettysburg. By afternoon on July 1st, Confederate forces had driven back the Yankees. Lee's subordinates, however, hesitated to take the strong Union positions on Culp's Hill. The result was that at the end of the first day at Gettysburg, the Federals held the high ground along the ridge. On July 2nd, Lee's forces, deployed more than a mile below Cemetery Ridge along a tree line called Seminary Ridge, faced Meade's line. The Yankees were deployed around Culp's Hill on their far right and the two Round Tops, Big Round Top and Little Round Top, on their extreme left, which were undefended. In the afternoon, the Confederates poured into the gap between Cemetery Hill and General Daniel Sickles's exposed position in the Peach Orchard. As the 1st Minnesota came across Cemetery Ridge in a marching column of fours, entirely unsuited to fight, General Winfield Scott Hancock ordered them to meet the rebels head-on. They did, still in their column of fours. Suffering 83% casualties, though not a man ran or fell prisoner of war, the Minnesotans blunted the Confederate advance. Meanwhile, upon learning that there were no troops on the Round Tops, Governor Warren sent Colonel Strong Vincent to defend it. Lee sought to take the Round Tops too and dispatched Longstreet's division to capture them, then roll up the Federal lines. John Bell Hood's Texas Division climbed up the hill to overrun Union positions opposed by the very end of the Union line. There, another legend of the war was born in Maine's Fighting Colonel Joshua Chamberlain. A Union regiment, the 20th Maine, commanded by Chamberlain, held the farthest point of the entire fishhook and thereby the fate of the entire army. A quiet professor of rhetoric at Bowdoin College, Chamberlain had volunteered with his Maine neighbors and his brother, who was his adjutant. 6 months previously, Chamberlain had charged up Mary's Heights at Fredericksburg, where he and what was left of his decimated troops were pinned down in the mud. All night he had listened to the whiz of musket balls and the screams of the wounded, using a dead man's coat to protect him from the chilling wind. From his position on the extreme left of the Union line, Chamberlain received word that the Confederates were advancing through the thick woods. Ordering his men to pile up brush, rocks, and anything to give them cover, the regiment beat back one attack after another by the determined rebel troops. Suddenly a cry went out that the Confederates had marched still farther to the Union left and that they intended to flank Chamberlain's position. Whether at his orders or at the suggestion of a subordinate, the 20th Maine refused the line, bending backward at a 45-degree angle to keep the Confederates in front of its fire. By that time, Chamberlain's men were almost entirely out of ammunition. Many had only 2 or 3 rounds left. Chamberlain shouted, "Bayonet! Forward to the right!" And the 20th Maine fixed bayonets. From its refused position, the Yankees swept down on the exhausted Confederates. The bold maneuver, combined with the shock of men racing downhill in a bayonet assault on weary attackers, shattered the Confederate advance, routing the rebels down the hill. Although fighting raged on for hours on both ends of the fishhook, Chamberlain's men had saved the Union Army. Chamberlain claimed he never felt fear in battle. "A soldier has something else to think about," he later explained. "As a rule, men stand up from one motive or another, simple manhood, force of discipline, pride, love, or bond of comradeship. The instinct to seek safety is overcome by the instinct of honor." Late in the evening of July 2nd, however, the engagement hardly seemed decisive. General George Pickett's division had just come up to join Lee, and Stuart had finally arrived. On the evening of July 2nd, ignoring the appeals from Longstreet to disengage and find better ground, Lee risked everything on a massive attack the following day. Longstreet's final attempt to dissuade Lee was met with the stony retort that he was "tired of listening, tired of talking." After 2 days of vicious fighting, Lee was convinced that the Federal flanks had been reinforced by taking men from the center, and that an all-out push in the middle would split their line in two. Pickett's charge, one of the most colorful and tragic of all American military encounters, began on July 3rd, when the South initiated a 2-hour artillery barrage on the middle of the Union line at Cemetery Ridge. Despite the massive artillery duel between Yankee and Rebel cannons, Lee did not know that under the withering steel torrent coming from his artillery, only about 200 Yankees had been killed and only a handful of Union guns destroyed. At 1:30 in the afternoon, Pickett's entire division, 15,000 men at least, emerged from the orchards behind the artillery. In long and glorious, well-ordered lines, a march of just under a mile began across open ground to attack the Federal position. Longstreet vociferously protested, "General Lee, there never was a body of 15,000 men who could make that attack successfully." At 1,000 yards, the Union artillery opened up, and at 100 yards, they changed to canisters, tiny cans filled with mini balls that flew in all directions upon impact. Row after row of rebels fell. Then the long lines of Yankee infantry, which had lain prone beneath the artillery rounds sailing over their heads, stood or kneeled when the rebels marched to within 200 yards to deliver a hailstorm of lead. Amazingly, Virginians under General Lewis Armistead reached the stone wall from which the Yankees were hurling a withering fire into their midst. Armistead stuck his general's hat on his saber and screamed, "Give them the cold steel!" Scaling the wall with about 200 Virginians following him, Armistead was killed. Known as the high water mark of the Confederacy, it was a scene later recaptured in film and art. Yet it lasted for only minutes as Union reserves poured new volleys into the exposed Confederates, then charged, reclaiming the stone wall. The attack utterly erased Pickett's division, with only half the 15,000 men who began the attack straggling back to rebel lines in the orchards. As they ran, a chant rose up from the Yankee infantry behind the stone wall. "Fredericksburg! Fredericksburg!" Reports trickled in to Longstreet, then Lee, who, in despair, kept repeating, "It's all my fault." The final tally revealed that the Army of Northern Virginia had taken a terrible beating at the hands of Meade. The Confederates lost 22,638, the Union 17,684. Yet the most important phase of Gettysburg had just started. Defeated and nearly broken, Could Lee escape? Would Meade blink and prove to be another McClellan and Hooker? Meade's son, a captain on his father's staff, wrote confidently on July 7th that Papa will end the war, a phrase the general himself made 2 days later in a missive to Washington when he said, I think the decisive battle of the war will be fought in a few days. Yet Meade did not follow up, even when it appeared that nature herself demanded the war end then and there. Storms had swollen the Potomac River, temporarily blocking Lee's escape. An aggressive general could have surrounded the demoralized Confederate army and crushed it by July 15, 1863. Instead, Lee's engineers hastily put up new pontoon bridges, and the rebels began to slip away. When he learned the news, Lincoln wept. Despite monumental failure, Meade also had achieved monumental success. He had done what no other Union general had done, whipped Bobby Lee in a head-to-head battle, and shattered the Army of Northern Virginia. That, in turn, meant that Lincoln had to be careful about how he dealt with Meade in public. He could not, for example, fire him outright. But the president continued to search for a general who would fight ceaselessly. When, simultaneously with Meade's victory, Ulysses S. Grant resolutely took Vicksburg in his ingenious campaign, Lincoln found his fighting general. From Chickamauga to Charleston. Gettysburg and Vicksburg marked a congruence of the war effort, a deadly double blow to the hopes of the Confederacy, capping a string of battlefield failures that met the Confederates in 1863. By that time, Ulysses Grant commanded all the military operations in the West, and he promptly sent Sherman to open up the road to Atlanta and the Deep South. Then, on March 10, 1864, Lincoln appointed Grant as supreme commander over all Union armies, and Grant, in turn, handed control of the Western War over to Sherman. William Tecumseh Sherman resembled Grant in many ways, not the least of which was in his utter failure in civilian life as a banker and lawyer. How much he owed his command to political favoritism, especially the influence wielded by his powerful brother John Sherman, the new senator from Ohio, is not clear. Unlike Grant, however, Sherman was already a Republican and a member of the radical wing of the Republican Party that opposed slavery on moral grounds. But he was also a racist, whose view of the inferiority of blacks, especially Negro troops, would bring him into constant friction with Lincoln, whom he despised. His unintended role in re-electing the president in 1864 nearly led him to switch parties, just as Grant had switched from Democrat to Republican over almost the same issues. Sherman's hatred of Lincoln, whom he labeled a black gorilla, echoing terms used by McClellan, was exceeded only by his animosity toward the Confederates. Although he admitted that Lincoln was honest and patient, he also added that Lincoln lacked dignity, order, and energy, many of the traits that McClellan also thought missing in the president. In late 1861, facing Confederate troops in Kentucky, Sherman became delusional, plummeting into a deep clinical depression that left him pacing his residence all night long, muttering to himself and drinking heavily. Thus, the relationship between Lincoln and Sherman, both probably manic depressives, was even more complex than either man realized. It remains one of the astounding pieces of history that the Union was saved by two depressives and a partially reformed drunk. After fighting effectively at Shiloh, Sherman received special praise from Grant and earned promotion after promotion. Grant named the red-haired Ohioan commander of all the armies in the West in the spring of 1864, with instructions to create havoc and destruction of all resources that would be beneficial to the enemy. On May 4, 1864, with almost 100,000 men, Sherman stuck a dagger into the heart of the South by attacking Atlanta. Joe Johnston's defending Confederate armies won minor engagements, but the overwhelming Union advantage in men and supplies allowed Sherman to keep up the pressure when Johnston had to resupply or rest. Jefferson Davis blamed Johnston, removing him in July in favor of John Bell Hood. But the fact was that even a mediocre general would have crushed Atlanta sooner or later. Sherman was no mediocre general. With Yankee troops on the outskirts of Atlanta, Hood burned the railroads and withdrew, and on September 1, 1864, Union forces entered the city. Offering the Confederates the opportunity to remove all civilians, Sherman announced he would turn the city into a military base. Hood, hoping to draw the federal troops away from Atlanta, moved around him to the north in an effort to destroy Sherman's supply lines. Sherman scoffed that he would supply him with rations all the way to Ohio if Hood would keep moving in that direction. Instead, Sherman headed south, preparing to live off the land and to destroy everything the Union Army did not consume. "War is hell," he soberly noted. Sherman's great victory at Atlanta constituted one of a trio of critical victories in late 1864, news of which reached Washington and the voters just as Lincoln was under political assault. One of Lincoln's detractors thus ensured his re-election. Politics in the North. By early 1864, in retrospect, Union victory seemed inevitable. U.S. Navy ships blockaded southern ports, breached only occasionally and ineffectively by blockade runners. The Mississippi now lay open from Missouri to the Gulf, while Texas, Arkansas, and Louisiana were surgically isolated from the rest of the Confederacy. In the far west, small important battles there had ensured that New Mexico, Utah, and California would remain in the Union and supply the federal effort with horses, cattle, gold, silver, and other raw materials. Braxton Bragg's northern defensive perimeter had shrunk from the Kentucky border on the north to Atlanta. In Virginia, Lee's army remained a viable but critically damaged fighting unit. Northern economic might had only come fully into play in 1863, and the disparities between the Union and Confederate abilities to manufacture guns, boots, clothes, ships, and, most important, to grow food were shocking. Given such a string of good news, Lincoln should have experienced stellar public approval and overwhelming political support. In fact, he clung to the presidency by his fingernails. Some of his weakened position emanated from his strong support of the man he had named commander of the Union armies. Ulysses Grant and Abraham Lincoln rarely corresponded, though Grant tended to send numerous messages to Halleck, who would, he knew, read them to Lincoln. A Douglas Democrat in 1860, Grant had nonetheless gravitated toward unequivocal emancipation, though he was not a vocal abolitionist. No one seems sure when he actually changed parties. Courted by the Democrats as a potential presidential nominee in 1864, Grant refused to be drawn into politics at that time and, in reality, never liked politics, even after he became president himself. By the fall of 1864, though, Grant endorsed Lincoln indirectly in a widely published letter. When Hooker descended to the low expectations many had of him, Grant expected his friend John Reynolds to command the Army of the Potomac. But the position went to Meade. Even after Lincoln gave Grant overall command of the army, he and the president were not particularly friendly, despite their similarities. For one thing, Mary Todd Lincoln, whose bitterness knew no bounds once it was directed at someone, despised Grant's wife, Julia. Grant intended to grind down the Confederates with a steady series of battles, even if none proved individually decisive. Grant's style caught the rebels off guard. One Confederate soldier wrote, We have been accustomed to a program which began with a federal advance, culminating in one great battle, and ended in the retirement of the Union Army, the substitution of a new federal commander for the one beaten, and the institution of a more or less offensive campaign on our part. This was the usual order of events, and this was what we confidently expected when General Grant crossed into the wilderness. But here was a new federal general, fresh from the West, and so ill-informed as to the military customs in our part of the country, that when the Battle of the Wilderness was over, instead of retiring to the north bank of the river and awaiting development of Lee's plans, he had the temerity to move by his left flank to a new position, there to try conclusions with us again. We were greatly disappointed with General Grant, and full of curiosity to know how long it was going to take him to perceive the impropriety of his course. The rebels quickly realized that the policy of pounding had begun and would continue until our strength should be utterly worn away. Grant's reputation began to suffer in May 1864 when he launched a new offensive through the wilderness again. 2 days of bloody fighting at the Second Battle of the Wilderness ensued, and more bodies piled up. On this occasion, however, Grant immediately attacked again and again. At Spotsylvania Courthouse, Lee anticipated Grant's attempt to flank him to get to Richmond, and the combat lasted 12 days. Despite the fact that Grant's armies failed to advance toward Richmond spatially, their ceaseless winnowing of the enemy continued to weaken Confederate forces and morale. It was costly, with the Union suffering 60,000 casualties in just over a month after Grant took over, and this politically damaged Lincoln. Continuing to try to flank Lee, Grant moved to Cold Harbor, where on June 1st he sent his men against entrenched positions. One Confederate watched with astonishment what he called inexplicable and incredible butchery. Yankee troops, recognizing the futility of their assaults, pinned their names and addresses to their coats to make identification of their bodies easier. One of Lee's generals saw the carnage and remarked, "This is not war, this is murder." Grant lost 7,000 men to the Confederates' 1,000. The only battle other than Fredericksburg in which the Army of Northern Virginia achieved any significant ratio of troops lost to the numbers engaged in the entire war. Cold Harbor was the only action that Grant ever regretted, a grand mistake of horrific human cost. Callous as it seemed, however, Grant had in more than a month inflicted on the Confederates 33,000 casualties, or more than Gettysburg and Antietam put together. Shifting unexpectedly to the south, Grant struck at Petersburg, where he missed an opportunity to occupy the nearly undefended city. Instead, a long siege evolved in which the spade took the place of the musket. Searching for a way to break through Lee's Petersburg fortifications, Grant received a plan from Colonel Henry Pleasants, a mining engineer in command of a regiment of Pennsylvania coal miners, who proposed tunneling under the fortifications and planting massive explosives to blast a hole in the Confederate defenses. On July 25th, the tunneling was completed, and tons of black powder were packed inside the tunnel. Troops prepared to follow up, including, at first, a regiment of black soldiers who, at the last minute, were replaced on Burnside's orders, having not only trained for the mission, but possessing the only appropriate tools for smashing the Confederate fortifications, all of which were inexplicably left behind when the white troops took over. When the charge detonated on July 30th, a massive crater was blown in the rebel lines, and the advancing troops actually penetrated Confederate lines, then, disorganized and insufficiently led, stopped. They milled around in and beyond the crater, allowing the Confederates to counterattack and push them back into the yawning hole. There, Federal troops were slaughtered by rebels firing down at them. It was another disaster, costing the Union 4,000 casualties and an opportunity to smash through the Petersburg defenses. Since 1862, Lincoln had faced turmoil inside his cabinet and criticism from both the radical Republicans and Democrats. Prior to 1863, anti-slavery men were angry with Lincoln for not pursuing emancipation more aggressively. At the same time, loyal war Democrats, or Unionists, who remained in Congress, nipped at his heels for the Army's early failings, especially the debacles of McDowell, Burnside, and Hooker. Their favorite, McClellan, who scarcely had a better record, nevertheless was excused from criticism on the grounds that Lincoln had not properly supported him. During the 1862 congressional election, criticism escalated, and the Republicans barely hung on to the House of Representatives, losing seats in five states where they had gained in 1860. These and other Democratic gains reversed a series of five-year gains for the Republicans, with the cruelest blow coming in Illinois, where the Democrats took nine seats to the Republicans' five and won the state legislature. Without the border states, James G. Blaine recalled, the hostile House might have overthrown his emancipation initiative. If the House losses were troublesome, Salmon Chase posed a genuine threat to the constitutional order. His financing measures had proven remarkably efficient, even if he ignored better alternatives. Yet his scheming against Seward, then Lincoln, was obvious to those outside the administration, who wrote of the Chase faction, "Their game was to drive all the cabinet out, then force the reappointment of Mr. Chase as premier, and form a cabinet of ultra-men around him." Seward, tired of the attacks, submitted his resignation without knowing the larger issues that swirled around him. Lincoln convened a meeting with several of the senators involved in the Chase schemes. Holding Seward's resignation in his hand, he demanded the resignation of all his cabinet, which he promptly placed in his top desk drawer and threatened to use if he heard of further intrigue. Lincoln's shrewd maneuver did not end the machinations by the radicals, but it severely dampened them for the rest of the war. An equally destabilizing issue involved the draft. Liberal Democrats and influential Republican editors like Horace Greeley opposed conscription. After announcement of the first New York conscriptees under the 1863 Enrollment Act, some 50,000 angry Irish, who saw that they were disproportionately represented on the lists, descended upon the East Side. Mobs terrorized and looted stores, targeting blacks in particular. Between 25 to 100 people died in the riots, and the mobs did $1.5 million in damage, requiring units from the U.S. Army to restore order. The new Gatling guns, the world's first machine gun, developed by American Richard Gatling, were turned on the rioting Irish. The rioters were in the unfortunate circumstance of confronting troops direct from Gettysburg, who were in no mood to give them any quarter. Another threat to the Union came from so-called Peace Democrats, known in the North as Copperheads for their treacherous, stealthy attacks. Forming secret societies, including the Knights of the Golden Circle, Copperheads forged links to the Confederacy. How far their activities went remains a matter of debate, but both Lincoln and Davis thought them significant. Peace Democrats propagandized Confederate success, recruited for the rebel cause, and in extreme situations, even stole supplies, destroyed bridges, and carried correspondence from Southern leaders. Even when arrested and convicted, Copperhead agitators often found sympathetic judges who quietly dismissed their cases and released them. At the opposite end of the spectrum, but no less damaging to Lincoln, were the radical Republicans. Congressional Republicans from 1861 onward clashed with the president over which branch had authority to prosecute the war. In May 1864, radicals held a meeting in Cleveland to announce their support of John C. Fremont as their presidential candidate in the fall elections. Rank-and-file Republicans who eschewed any connection to the radicals held what would have been, under other circumstances, the real Republican convention in June and renominated Lincoln. However, in an effort to cement the votes of war or Unionist Democrats, Lincoln replaced Hannibal Hamlin, his vice president, with a new nominee, Democrat Andrew Johnson of Tennessee. The main source of radical opposition to Lincoln targeted his view of reconstructing the Union. Radicals sought the utter prostration of the South. Many had looked forward to the opportunity to rub the South's nose in it, and Lincoln's moderation was not what they had in mind. Two of the most outspoken radicals, Benjamin F. Wade of Ohio and Henry W. Davis of Maryland, authored a bill to increase the number of persons required to sign loyalty oaths to 50% and to ensure black civil rights. The Wade-Davis bill flew in the face of Lincoln's consistently stated desire to reunite the nation as quickly and peacefully as possible, and it would have provoked sufficient Southern antipathy to lengthen the war through guerrilla warfare. Yet Lincoln feared that Congress might override a veto, so he exercised a special, well-timed pocket veto, in which he took no action on the bill. Congress adjourned in the meantime, effectively killing the legislation, which infuriated the radicals even more. Wade and Davis issued the Wade-Davis Manifesto, which indicted not only Lincoln's plan for reunification, but also disparaged his war leadership. All of these factors combined to produce a remarkable development in the late summer and early fall of 1864, in which some Republican Party members started to conduct a quiet search for a nominee other than Lincoln. At the Democratic Convention in August, George B. McClellan emerged as the nominee. He planned to run on a restoration of the Union with no change in the Confederacy, except that the Richmond government would dissolve. Adopting a peace plank, Democrats essentially declared that 3 years of war had been for naught, that no principles had been affirmed. Here was an astonishingly audacious and arrogant man, an incompetent and arguably traitorous Democratic general, running against his former commander-in-chief in time of war and on a peace platform 6 months before the war was won. The peace plank proved so embarrassing that even McClellan soon had to disavow it. Even so, facing McClellan and the purer Republican Fremont, Lincoln privately expected to be voted out. At about that time, Lincoln received welcome news that Admiral David Farragut had broken through powerful forts to capture Mobile Bay on August 5, 1864. Threatened by Confederate torpedoes, in reality mines, Farragut exhorted his sailors with the famous phrase, "Damn the torpedoes, full speed ahead!" Other important Confederate ports, most notably Charleston and Wilmington on the Atlantic, held out but remained blockaded. With Mobile safely in Union hands, the major Gulf Coast rebel cities had surrendered. Farragut's telegrams constituted the first of three highly positive pieces of war news that ensured Lincoln's re-election. The second was Sherman's early September report of the fall of Atlanta. Sherman recommended that Grant order him to march southward from Atlanta to cut a swath through to the sea, taking Savannah. In the process,